standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the Q&A session of today's call. At that time, you may press star one when you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'd like to turn the meeting over to Ms. Laura Fortman, Deputy Administrator for the Wade and Allen Division. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. And before I turn this over to Laura, this is Mary Lee Fay from NASDES, and I'd like to welcome everyone who is on the line and thank the Department of Labor and their staff for putting on this webinar on behalf of members for the National Association of State Directors of Developmental Disabilities, the National Association of States United in Aging and Disabilities, and the National Association of Medicaid Directors. All of you are members of one of those organizations, and this call will be recorded, and the recording will be posted on our website along with a PowerPoint in a few days after this presentation. A couple features for today's call. You are all on mute, as the operator indicated, but you might want to think about asking questions as we go along. The chat function is on the left-hand side. And we just got an email that says the conference call-in number and password are different in the email. So I'm going to put it on the note to make sure up in the notes so everyone can hear it. So I will check that out. Thank you for letting us know. In the meantime, please use the chat room. We'll follow your questions along, and I'm going to turn it over to Laura Tatum.
Actually, we're doing lots of switching of names. This is Laura Fortman. I'm the Deputy Administrator for Wage and Hour, and I do have a cold, so I apologize for my voice. But I did want to just take a moment to say thank you very much to all of you for joining us this afternoon, and as well as to thank NASDES, NAMID, NASUAD, and all the state officials for working with us as we prepared the shared living guidance. The purpose of today's webinar is to briefly review the home care final rule, walk through the department's guidance regarding the application of the Fair Labor Standards Act and the home care final rule, and the impact on shared living arrangements, and then take your questions. Now, your assistance throughout this process has been invaluable in helping us identify the various common shared living scenarios, helping us connect with states and providers, and also helping us think through questions about the application of the Fair Labor Standards Act and the final rule. We greatly appreciate all of your time and effort. I also want to take this opportunity to thank our colleagues at HHS who worked closely with us to help the shared living guidance, and we continue to work with them as we develop additional guidance. There has been a small working group made up of staff from the Department of Labor, from Health and Human Services, and in particular, I want to extend thanks to Allison Barkov and James Taze for their invaluable work. It has truly been a collaborative effort. And as we were working through this, both DOL and HHS remained committed to dual principles. We wanted to make sure that this rule expands wage protections for direct care workers while at the same time ensuring that Medicaid participants and their families continue to have access to critical community services to support the innovative models of care that help them live in the community. Again, thank you for joining us today, and at this point I'd like to turn it over to Michael Hancock.
Thank you, Laura, and I want to thank everyone on the phone for taking the time today and allowing us the opportunity to try to walk you through the changes we made in the home care rule and then a deeper dive into how the FLSA principles apply to various shared living arrangements. And as Laura indicated, this guidance is in large part the product of the collaboration that we had with HHS, Allison and James, but also reflects the information and that you and others in your network have provided to us to help us have a deeper understanding of these innovative shared living arrangements so that we could develop this guidance about the FLSA application. I'm going to turn this over to my colleague Serena Basilet in a moment, but I first want to just say a few words about the FLSA broadly. The Fair Labor Standards Act is the federal law that requires employers to pay employees minimum wage and overtime. The FLSA applies to about 7.5 million employers and covers about 135 million employees. It's the employment standard that has the broadest application in the U.S. Changes we made to the regulations were issued in October of 2013, and we established at that time an unprecedented 15-month delayed effective date. We thought that was appropriate in these circumstances because we understand that the changes that we made in the home care rule will impact some very complex systems of delivery, particularly in the Medicaid world. And we thought it was appropriate to allow a period to make the necessary adjustments both to program but also to budgets and operations that will allow for a smoother transition to these new obligations. Today, we will provide a summary first of the home care final rule. I know that it's been now over almost 9 months since we issued that, and it may be useful to give people a refresher on what we did in the actual home care rule. But then we'll take some time to talk about the guidance that we issued in March about how the FLSA and this rule applies to shared living arrangements. I will now turn it over to my colleague, Serena Basilet, who will walk you through the home care final rule.
Thank you, Michael. With the home care final rule, certain domestic service employees are exempt from FLSA protection. There is an exemption for workers providing companionship services and a second exemption for live-in domestic service employees. Specifically, workers performing companionship services are exempt from both minimum wage and overtime requirements. However, live-in domestic service workers are exempt only from the overtime requirement. Domestic service employment means work in the private home of the person receiving services. The final rule changed who can claim the exemption. Third-party employers like a private home care agency or a public agency that administers a consumer-directed program may no longer claim either the companionship services or the live-in domestic service worker exemption. With that being said, consumers, their families, and households may continue to claim the exemptions provided that the applicable criteria for the exemptions are met. Please note, a third-party employer is any employer other than the consumer, the consumer's family, or their household. The final rule defines companionship services as the provision of fellowship and protection. Companionship services may also include that provision of care if that care is provided attendant to and in conjunction with the provision of fellowship and protection, and if that care does not exceed 20% of the total hours worked per work week. Beginning January 1, 2015, if the direct care worker does not meet this definition of companionship services, the worker is not exempt and must be paid at least the FLSA minimum wage and receive overtime pay when he or she works more than 40 hours in a work week. So what is fellowship and protection? Fellowship means engaging a person in social, physical, or mental activity, having conversations with them, reading, playing games, and similar types of activity. Protection means to be present with that person in his or her home or to accompany them when they're outside of the home to monitor their safety and their well-being. The final rule defines care as assisting the person or the consumer with activities of daily living, or ADL, and instrumental activities of daily living, or IADL.
Examples of ADLs noted in the final rule include dressing, grooming, feeding, bathing, toileting, and transferring. And the examples of IADLs noted in the final rule include things like meal preparation, driving, light housework, managing finances, assistance with physical taking of medication, and arranging medical care. Remember, if a direct care worker spends more than 20% of his or her time during the work week assisting with ADLs or IADLs, he or she is not providing companionship services that week and is entitled to minimum wage and overtime protection. Companionship services does not include the performance of medically related services for the consumer. The determination of whether services are medically related is based on whether the services typically require and are performed by trained personnel, such as registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, or certified nursing assistants. The determination is not based on the actual training or the occupational title of the person performing the services. Of course, assistance with certain IADLs, such as reminding the consumer to take particular medication or opening a pill container, would not be considered medically related services, but rather part of care services. The final rule does not change the definition of live-in domestic service worker. A live-in domestic service employee is a worker who resides in the private home where he or she works on a permanent basis or for an extended period of time. Let's define these two terms, permanent basis and extended period of time. On a permanent basis means that the worker works and sleeps on the employer's premises 7 days per week and therefore has no home of his or her own other than the one provided by the employer. Extended periods of time means that the worker works and sleeps on the employer's premises for 5 days a week or sleeps on the employer's premises for five consecutive days or nights. For example, workers who reside on the employer's premises 5 consecutive days from 9 a.m. Monday until 5 p.m. Friday, sleeping 4 straight nights on the premises would be considered to reside on the employer's premises for an extended period of time. Please note, we want to emphasize that the fact that an individual or consumer may need 24 hours of care does not necessarily make the worker a live-in domestic service employee. The other change made by the final rule concerning live-in workers is the record-keeping requirement. A live-in domestic service worker and the employer may make an agreement excluding from hours worked, sleep time, meal time, and other periods of complete freedom from all duties or work. This time would not be considered work time or hours worked, and the employee need not be paid. Please keep in mind that the rules regarding the reasonable agreement applies to all employers of live-in employees, including third-party employers who are prohibited to claim the live-in domestic service employee exemption. The FLSA requires that the employer must keep a record of this reasonable agreement. Under the final rule, the employer must also keep records of the actual hours worked by the live-in domestic service employee. The employer may assign or task the employee with creating and submitting those records, but the employer is ultimately responsible for maintaining such records. Fact Sheet 79B provides a general overview of live-in domestic service workers under the FLSA. Now Michael Hancock will present Topic 2 on shared living arrangements and walk you through the department's guidance related to that topic.
Thank you, Serena. Before I start with the actual guidance, I just wanted to say that we developed the shared living guidance in large measure in response to questions raised after the rule was issued from a number of different places in the disability community in particular. And we relied heavily on the information that was provided by, among others, people on this phone call, to develop guidance that we think actually addresses real-world circumstances that you are likely to encounter as you administer Medicaid programs. The guidance that we issued is found on our website, and just to remind everyone, we have a dedicated page on our website that contains compliance material on home care, and you will find there the administrator's interpretation number 2014-1 and fact sheet number 79G that address specifically the shared living guidance. By shared living, the department means arrangements in which the consumer and the provider live together. This can take different forms, and I guess there are probably as many shared living arrangements out there as one's imagination can conjure, but we tried to break these down into two discrete groups. The first, the shared living in the home of the provider. That is, the consumer moves into the home of the provider and the services are provided there. The second kind of shared living that we address are arrangements in which the provider moves into the home of the consumer. Now, we recognize that there may be some gray areas where it's not entirely clear whether it's the consumer or the provider's home. And we've included in this guidance the kinds of considerations that one needs to take into account in making that determination. The term shared living includes programs often called adult foster care, host home, paid roommate, supported living, life sharing, and other such designations. It does not refer to roommates or family who have no expectation of payment, i.e., providing exclusively natural support. What we did not do in this final rule is turn all supports into paid employment relationships. So to the extent that families and others are doing this without any expectation of payment, they do not fall within the coverage of the Fair Labor Standards Act. It also does not refer to programs in which services are provided in group homes or via shift work, regardless of whether the programs are called by these names. And finally, it doesn't necessarily mean live-in under the FLSA, as discussed earlier by Serena. For each shared living arrangement, there are two important questions that need to be answered in determining what, if any, obligations are owed under the Fair Labor Standards Act. First, does the Fair Labor Standards Act apply? That is there coverage under the Act? Secondly, if we do determine that there is coverage, how do employers comply with the Fair Labor Standards Act? The guidance groups shared living arrangements into two major categories, as I indicated earlier, in the provider's home or services that occur in the consumer's home. Let me first address in a provider's home. The FLSA applies to employees, not to independent contractors. A home care provider could be an employee of a consumer or of a third party only if neither is her employer is she an independent contractor. In most shared living arrangements that occur in a provider's home, again, often referred to as adult foster care or host home, the provider will be determined to be an independent contractor and therefore outside the scope of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The second arrangement occurs in a provider's home. Why is the provider usually an independent contractor? Well, there's a number of reasons, and let me just highlight a few. The provider will not be an employee of the consumer because when the shared living arrangement occurs in the provider's home, the provider is in control and has invested in the residence. That's a potent indicator of independent contractor status. Second, the provider will not be an employee of the third party if the third party overseeing the program but does not become heavily involved in directing the work. For example, the third party does not manage the residence or direct the provider regarding the day-to-day care of the consumer, does not set hours, does not set other indicia of employment. When is a provider instead of an employee? It's just because the services are being provided in the provider's home does not in and of itself mean that that provider cannot be an employee. So let's look at some of the factors that may lead to the conclusion that they are, in fact, an employee of someone. If the third party is more involved in the provider's relationship with a consumer, that could make that third party an employer. For example, if a case manager instructs the provider on how to perform tasks, or if that third party finds and rents the residence in which the shared living arrangement occurs, or if a third party negotiates the terms of the provider's employment, such as wages, benefits, vacation, time off, those sorts of things, all are indications of an employment relationship. Now, one of the questions that came up as we were talking to people in the community and as we were developing the guidance is whether or not a family care provider could fit into this model of adult foster care or host home. Some state programs allow a family member of the consumer to be in a foster care provider. The provider status as a family member, as opposed to someone unrelated, and the fact that the consumer may have already lived with the family member before he or she became a provider is not determinative of whether the family member is an employee or an independent contractor. The same factors that we examined in making a determination that most unrelated providers providing services in the provider's home are not an employee are the same factors that we would look at for a family member and apply the same economic realities analysis in making a determination. So a family care provider could be an independent contractor under those circumstances. The other question that came up as we were examining services provided in the provider's home is the status of respite workers. A separate analysis is conducted to determine whether any other workers in the home, usually respite or relief workers, but it could extend to other sorts of care providers, is an employee for the purposes of FLSA. Whether any particular worker is an employee or an independent contractor under the FLSA depends on the same economic realities test that we applied to the providers. And this considers whether the worker is economically dependent on the potential employer or is instead in business for herself. This often arises under circumstances where either the provider retains the respite worker or a third-party entity like a staffing agency or some other entity may be involved in making those respite worker arrangements, and the same economic realities test is the one that we will apply to determining the status of a respite worker. Depending on the particular circumstances, a respite worker could be an employee of, as I indicated, the adult foster care provider or a private or public agency. In most cases, a provider or agency will control the worker's services, such as setting their schedule, directing the worker on the tasks to be performed, even setting their hours when they're to be there. The worker will have no opportunity for profit or loss, but will instead receive wages. The worker will not have invested in the relationship, and the worker will provide services that are integral to the business of the potential employer. All these are indicators that there's an employment relationship. Based on these particular facts, we think that the economic realities test will most often lead to the conclusion that the respite workers are employees of someone, whether it's the adult foster care provider or some other agency, and is entitled to FLSA minimum wage and overtime coverage. Now, the second kind of shared living arrangements that we examined in this guidance occurs in the consumer's home. In most shared living arrangements that occur in the consumer's home, the provider will be an employee of the consumer. Now, bear in mind that I said in most of these living arrangements, it's not necessarily the case in every arrangement. Why is that? Well, just as we indicated in looking at services provided in the provider's home, the consumer in this instance controls the residence, sets the schedule, has a lot of control over the how the work's done, when it's done, and by whom. Therefore, we think in most of these instances, the FLSA will apply if there is coverage and if no other exemption applies. The coverage under these arrangements is fairly simple. Because the work that's being performed in the consumer's home fits the definition of service, domestic service employment under the FLSA, that establishes coverage. There are, however, several exemptions that we need to consider, even as we determine that there is probably an employment relationship. The consumer might be able to claim either or both of the FLSA exemptions updated by the final rule. As Serena indicated, the companionship services exemption from minimum wage and overtime continues to be available to the consumer who is also an employer. So we need to consider whether or not the duties being performed fit the companionship exemption, but if they do, the consumer can claim the companionship exemption for minimum wage and overtime. The live-in domestic service employee exemption, to the extent the provider meets the definition of a live-in employee, exempts that provider from overtime. The provider might, at the same time as they're determined to be an employee of the consumer, could also be determined to be an employee of a third party. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act economics realities test, it is possible to have more than one employer at the same time for the same work being performed. This differentiates it from most other definitions of employment, whether it's under the IRS code or elsewhere. So this is an important factor that we need to consider when we're looking at shared living arrangements. The major factor to consider in the third part is the third party's control over the provider's work. For example, if a provider must ask the third party's permission to be away from the residence or to make changes to the consumer's daily schedule, these facts weigh in favor of finding that the provider is an employee of this third party. On the other hand, if the provider must notify the third party that she will be away from the residence overnight, but the third party cannot refuse to grant her request or sanction her for taking the time off, that fact would tend to weigh in favor of independent contractor status vis-a-vis that third party. Again, these arrangements involve domestic service employment, so there will almost always be coverage if a third party employs a shared living provider whose services occur in the consumer's home. Under the final rule, the third party employer may not claim the companionship or the live-in domestic service exemption, so no such exemption applies to that third party employer. I want to add, however, that the consumer in these circumstances, even where there is a joint employment third party, the consumer and the household continues to enjoy both of those exemptions. Now, there's a variation on the more typical shared living arrangements that we just talked about, in which it's clear that the services are being rendered in the consumer's in a home controlled by the consumer. What if the home is new to both the provider and the consumer? Consider the facts and circumstances to determine whether the provider or the consumer has primary control over the residence and the relationship. The facts that we will look at in making that determination include who found the residence, who arranged to buy or lease it, who furnished the common areas, who maintains the residence, that is, who makes decisions about making repairs, who arranges those repairs, who does the cleaning or arranges for that cleaning. And and another factor that's important in this determination is who pays the mortgage or the rent. These are often areas of gray that we would have to consider in making that determination, but we understand that these arrangements are becoming more common. Now, if the FLSA is determined to apply, that is, there's coverage and there's no exemption that can be claimed, the FLSA requires that an employer pay the minimum wage for all hours worked, pays overtime compensation for all hours worked over 40 in a work week, and maintains the required employment records. I want to talk a little bit about how we determine what the hours worked are for the employee and then calculate whether the FLSA minimum wage and overtime requirements are satisfied. In doing this, we're applying well-established principles under the FLSA, and these principles weren't changed by the home care rule that was issued in October. So the first issue I want to address is what constitutes hours worked under the Fair Labor Standards Act. This includes all the time spent performing tasks for the employer or waiting to perform such tasks for the employer. Let me give you a few examples. addressing the consumer, driving the consumer to the doctor's office, and then waiting in the waiting room to drive that consumer home from an appointment, taking the consumer out for a walk to get fresh air, to go to the park. Those are all things that constitute hours worked. Hours worked also includes time spent working outside of the scheduled or assigned hours if the employer knows or has reason to know that work is occurring. Because it can often be difficult to distinguish between a live-in employee's on-duty and off-duty time, there are special rules that have long applied that allow us to differentiate between compensable hours worked and time off. Specifically, an employer and a live-in employee may enter into a reasonable agreement that describes accurately the work the employee is to perform and the time designated as excluded from hours worked. Now, typically, this takes the form of an agreement in which the employer says, I expect you to be on duty between 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. You're free until 2 in the afternoon, when I expect you to be on duty again until 7 in the evening. Otherwise, you're free to use that time as you choose. This is particularly important in the context of shared living, where the need for a clear and specific reasonable agreement will protect both parties. The employer and the employee alike have a clear understanding of what the expectations are, and that can go a long way in avoiding disputes over what is compensable hours worked and what isn't. Some tasks are easy to classify as work and as off-duty activities. For instance, time spent helping the consumer bathe, toilet, dress, other such things are clearly hours worked. On the other hand, if the provider is completely relieved from duty and chooses to use that time to take a college course or chooses to use that time to go to the corner coffee shop, that is clearly not work time. Other activities may occur during either on-duty or off-duty, depending on the context. For example, going to a community event together at a time when the provider could choose to be apart from the consumer could be unpaid if a reasonable agreement only requires the provider to assist the consumer at certain times a day. On the other hand, going to the same event together could be hours worked if the reasonable agreement states that the provider's duty include engaging the consumer in community activities. The more specific the agreement is, the less likely it is that we're going to have serious disputes over what is on and off-duty time. Now, I hasten to add, the actual time spent performing work must be compensated, even if it's greater than that anticipated in the reasonable agreement. It may be permissible for the reasonable agreement between the employer and the live-in employee to exclude from hours worked up to 8 hours per night of the provider's sleep time. Again, the reasonable agreement can provide for sleep time up to 8 hours a night. The sleep time must be during normal sleeping hours, i.e. overnight. I don't think that we would determine an agreement that said sleep time is between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. to be a reasonable exclusion of sleep time. The provider must typically be paid for some hours during non-sleep time. The agreement must be reasonable. Now, let's look at a couple of examples that illustrate this point. If a provider is paid for services performed between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. each evening, and again between 6 a.m. and 8 a.m. each morning, the 8 hours of sleep time in between may be excluded by this reasonable agreement. If the provider is required to sleep at the residence 5 nights a week and 4 hours per day on 2 weekdays, and each weekend day are paid, up to 8 hours of sleep, again, may be excluded by the reasonable agreement. If the provider's sole responsibility is to be at the residence 5 nights a week between 10 p.m. and 8 a.m., however, it will likely be reasonable to agree to treat 2 of those 10 hours as hours worked and exclude the remaining 8 hours as sleep time. let's look at the other side of that coin. But if the provider's sole responsibility is to be at the residence overnight 5 nights a week, excluding all of the time or considering just 1 hour per night to be hours worked, would not be considered to be reasonable. So I want to take just a moment to talk about compliance with the FLSA. And it has three fairly simple, straightforward obligations. One, pay the federal minimum wage, which is currently $7.25 per hour. An employee must receive at least that rate for all hours that are determined to be hours worked. The overtime obligation requires that an employee receive 1.5 times her hourly rate of pay for each hour worked over 40 in a work week. Now, I want to emphasize here, it's the hourly rate of pay and not the minimum wage. So if the hourly rate of pay for an employee is $9 per hour, that's the rate that we calculate the overtime obligation against. The Fair Labor Standards Act also requires that employers keep records regarding their employees and hours worked. The final rule mandated that the employers of live-in employees comply with this record-keeping obligation, but also provides that the employer can delegate that obligation to the employee. Under certain circumstances, an employer may take a credit towards the minimum wage of the fair value of things like rent, utilities, and board. This is often called the Section 3M credit after that part of the FLSA where this requirement is found. A separate guidance document that explains in detail when an employer may take a 3M credit is forthcoming. And once that guidance has been issued, we'll provide further opportunities to have conversations like we're having today. Now, let me illustrate the 3M credit in a couple of concrete examples. To calculate the hourly rate, including a Section 3M credit, the value of the room and board is added to the cash wages paid and divided by the hours worked in any given work week. Let's assume that a provider receives $6 per hour as a cash wage and lodging, the fair value of which is $100 per week. This means that the provider has earned $180 in cash wages, an additional $100 as a 3M credit, and you divide that by the 30 hours that they worked, and you have an hourly rate of $9.33 per hour. This rate clearly complies with the federal minimum wage requirement of $7.25 per hour. Now, let's look at a similar scenario in an overtime work week. Assume that the next week the provider works 50 hours. You add the $300 in cash wages to the $100 that they are credited towards the 3M housing credit and divide by 50 hours, yielding an hourly rate of $8 per hour. The provider is owed an additional $40 in overtime compensation. That concludes the presentation. Before we turn to questions, I just want to draw your attention to some sources of information that you may find helpful going forward. As I indicated earlier, we have a dedicated home care website. The address is posted on your computer. We also have created a special mailbox that is dedicated to receiving questions concerning home care and including the shared living guidance that we issued. And if you have additional questions, you can pose those questions at homecare@dol.gov. We monitor that inbox and we'll get back to you with a response if at all possible. Now, there's another way that you can get guidance. We have a toll-free number. It's 1-866-487-9243, and this number will put you in touch with a call center that can direct you to the local wage and hour division office where you can ask questions about the FLSA's general application, but also get information about the home care rule. That concludes the presentation.
Michael, we have one question before we open it up. One question came in the chat box, and the question is, would the consumer still be the employer if a third party does the Medicaid billing for the service?
Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, we use the economic realities test to evaluate the relationship. That a third party plays a role, in this case through does the Medicaid billing, is not necessarily determinative. We would have to look at all the facts and circumstances surrounding that relationship and apply the economic realities test to those facts and circumstances before we could give you an answer. Now, let me say at this point, we did not take a deep dive into the employment relationship today, and I know that's an issue that people have a lot of interest in. As we've said in other at other times and other places, we hope to have some fairly detailed guidance about employment relationship in this context soon. And once that guidance is available, we will provide additional opportunities like we did today to answer your questions and give you a little more detail about that guidance. So that should be forthcoming soon.
Okay, thank you. We will continue to monitor the chat box if there are questions typed in there, but for now, let's open up the lines if we could and see if anyone wants to ask a question.
Thank you. At this time, we will begin the question and answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Please be sure your phone is unmuted and record your name when prompted. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, press star 1 on your touchtone phone. Moment for our first question.
I'll give you a few seconds if anyone wants to ask the question. Hearing no questions, I'd just like to thank you, Michael. Again, the presentation was very
I'm sorry, excuse me. I'm sorry, excuse me. There are questions. They're not recording their name, so I'm going to introduce the next person that was in line. One moment, please.
Okay.
We don't necessarily need their names. Operator, we can take questions even if they don't want to identify themselves by name.
Sure. I can open the line at this time. Call if you press star 1. Your line is open. And I couldn't get them to respond either. I'll just move
okay.
to the – one moment. I'll move to the next question. And the next question comes from Shelley O'Gregg. Your line is open.
Yes. I wanted to know, kind of like a follow-up on the question that was asked about would the consumer still be an employee if a third-party person did the Medicaid billing? A lot of the description of the employer and consumer, the person's relationship, a lot of it mirrored language used for self-direction. And so, it does sound like the individual themselves who is employing their staff, and it sounds like a self-directed type of a framework or setup. So is it anticipated, or I never heard the word self-direction, but this sounds like a self-directed type service. Is there any validity to that?
Well, I think a lot of the examples that were used in the shared living guidance were drawn from programs that really have a heavy consumer-directed component. And in which the consumer really does a lot of the decision-making around the employment relationship. So to the extent that those were the examples that we included in the shared living guidance, I think that they were in the consumer's home, those were really pretty heavily focused on consumer-directed programs.
Okay. I think that's why I was a little confused when, and I do appreciate you wanting to give an accurate answer, that is the question about the consumer as the employer if there's a third-party billing was difficult because under self-direction, that's a common practice using a fiscal intermediary or a fiscal management service entity to do the billing, but the person is still considered, you know, an employer or a co-employer or a co-manager.
And again, I think you'll see coming soon some fairly comprehensive guidance that goes a little deeper into how we would evaluate circumstances in which there may be more than one person providing some employer-related function. And I think that probably we should wait for that guidance, and we can have another conversation once that guidance is out and you have a chance to digest it.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Kathy. Your line is open.
Hello. I'm wondering who is responsible for enforcing or monitoring that the minimum wage is being paid?
Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Wage and Hour Division has responsibility for enforcing the provisions of that act, minimum wage, overtime, record keeping. And so compliance under the Fair Labor Standards Act falls squarely under wage and hour enforcement responsibilities. I need to add that the Fair Labor Standards Act contains a private right of action as well as administrative enforcement by the Wage and Hour Division. So under most circumstances, not all, but under most circumstances, the employee has a private right of action, so can sue directly. One of the major exceptions to that is that the states retain sovereign immunity under the Fair Labor Standards Act, which means that individual employees are not able to sue states that claim sovereign immunity under the Act. It's important to note that the Fair Labor Standards Act also provides that states and localities can have their own minimum wage overtime requirements that exceed the Fair Labor Standards Act or that stand parallel to the Fair Labor Standards Act. So in many states, not all, but in many states, there may be, in addition to the Fair Labor Standards Act, state or local wage and hour-like requirements that are enforced by that state or that municipality or that county.
Well, we're wondering, as a state agency, if we become aware that someone isn't, or do we have to kind of confirm that they are being paid at least the minimum wage? Or is that the responsibility of the employee that if they feel they're not, they should contact you?
I think that typically we respond to complaints. So, and that complaint can come from an individual employee or it can come from any other source that has credible information about potential violations.
Okay.
So it can come from any number of places.
Thank you.
And our next question and last question comes from Ms. Newman. Ms. Newman, your line is open.
Hi. Yes, on slide number 18, it refers to a third party does not manage the residents or direct the provider regarding how to care for the consumer. And I'm just wondering how does that mesh with if the service is being provided through a Medicaid 1915C waiver that has service descriptions and provider qualifications that may include things like training to conditions specific to the consumer and that sort of thing. Is there a conflict there because presumably the state still has an interest in the way that that service is provided and it must be provided consistent with the specifications in the waiver?
Mm-hmm. Again, that's among the issues that we are considering in the additional employment relationship guidance. Those very sort of factors are something that we hope to address soon in the additional guidance in which we examine how that line's drawn under the circumstances that you described. So I think you'll see additional guidance that will be helpful on that question.
And I'll just also add that the administrator's interpretation letter contains a lot more detail than was in the slide about typical roles of either a state agency or the adult foster care agency, and the roles that they play that still could keep them from having someone be an employee, and they can continue being an independent contractor. So I think some of the questions that you raise, if you look at the AI in more detail, that also may be helpful.
And I think you'll see that we recognize that there's a difference between sort of program integrity and licensure and that sort of thing, and the kind of control that typically is considered in making a employment relationship determination.
Michael,
Thank
we have
you.
Another question in the chat box, a scenario question. This reads, when a father, mother, child live in the same home and the mother is the designated employee, the father is the designated employer, and assuming the companionship exemption is met, would the mother be entitled to overtime?
The father is entitled as a member of the household, as we made clear in the regulation, the household and the consumer may continue to claim the benefit of the companionship exemption so long as they meet the definition of companionship services. So in that instance that you describe, the companionship exemption would continue. Now, that's true only if there's not a third-party employer involved in that relationship, but that was not part of your hypothetical, so I'd say the companionship exemption would apply.
Thank you. Operator, are there other calls in the queue?
No further questions in queue.
Well, before I turn this back over to the operator to conclude this call, I want to thank everybody for taking the time today. I hope this was helpful. I would ask you to stand by for additional guidance on things like 3M and the employment relationship. We'll have other opportunities to have this conversation moving forward. And let me turn it over to Mary Lee and see if she has any concluding words.
Thank you, Noah. We will, all the associations are interested in questions that the state have, so please continue to send questions into your state association. We're working closely with staff here at the Department of Labor. The PowerPoint will be available on the websites, NASDES, NASAWAD, and NAMD, along with a recording of this call and the call that occurred last week. Again, these were two sessions using the same information, but we had a fabulous turnout for both of these calls, well over 300 to 400 people participating between the 2 weeks. So we really appreciate your working with us here, and hopefully this format has worked well, and when we get further guidance, we hope to conduct similar websites. So thank you all very much. Appreciate
Thank you.
Your time.
Sure.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. You may disconnect at this time.